From WXXI News, this is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Our connection this hour was made on a beautiful spring evening on someone's front patio. You heard me right. Their front patio. Have you seen one? Most of us who are fortunate to live in a house don't have a front patio. Most of our gatherings are in the backyard. Patios and back. It's the city planning version of the mullet. Business in front, party in back. And it turns out some city and town planners want it that way. Depending on where you live, you might not be permitted to have a front patio. For urbanists, that might seem absurd. If we're trying to create a sense of community, why are we forcing people to their backyards? If we want to gather and get to know our neighbors, how do these kinds of rules help? And that got me thinking. What is the 2021 wish list for local urbanists and planners? What rules or laws or regulations are in the way of building community? What could change and change quickly to make our world a little bit more connected? My guest this hour would be happy to join you for your non-mullet patio, the front patio, the party in front. I think they would anyway. Jason Partika is the chair of the bus work group at Reconnect Rochester. How do you feel about the party in front, Jason?
Oh, the more the merrier, right? Got to have it facing the street and people can join in.
Facing the street. There you go. Molly Gaudioso is a senior community planner at Barton and Logwood East. Molly, welcome. Thanks for being with us.
Thank you. I'm happy to be part of this conversation.
And Brendan Ryan is an engineer who sits on the board of Reconnect Rochester. Brendan, welcome to you as well.
Thank you.
So let me ask all three of you, just as we get started here, when we think about our community and what has changed, if you look at what the Congress for New Urbanism says about just the public conversation about connected communities, there's this idea that 20 years ago, we were barely talking about walkability at all. Now it's part of most discussions, that there's been a lot of good progress, but the Congress for New Urbanism has their own list of ideas that still need to be implemented more widely. Is there low-hanging fruit here? Jason, are there ideas that you think, I can't believe we're not doing X, Y, and Z?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. I think for things like new construction, things like just minimum setbacks, like we require big front yards now, they kind of make it hard to be neighborly. You know, I think when I first moved to the city, I would walk down my street and people would sit on the porch and you could kind of chat with them. And now you have to kind of shout across a big front lawn to talk to them. I think as we start to infill the city, we really should talk about how big a front yard we require or those kind of things.
So you use the term minimum setbacks there, Jason. That's the term? That's, I guess, the technical legal term, right?
Yeah. So, like, you know, you have to, like, push the house back far enough from the sidewalk. So you can't put it, like, right on, as close to the sidewalk as maybe some of our neighborhoods you see today now.
Okay. So the house has got to be set back. But you're not supposed to have a patio there either. It's just supposed to be, I guess, yard or stone. What is the purpose of that? And I don't mean that like flippantly, Jason. What do you think the purpose of that regulation is?
I think people think, you know, as we started to sprawl out and people moved to the suburbs, I think people thought the city would have to compete with that, you know. So, you know, you see that now. Like if you want a new construction, you need a bigger lot. We have 40-foot lots, but now you need a 60-foot lot. And you need a big front yard and things like that just to have a lot of space. But I think that was a little misguided, we've seen. I don't think you can out-compete the suburbs in an urban environment, and it just hasn't worked out. So
that is one of the legacies of seeing the rise of the suburbs, is this idea that city planning must correspond to it and sort of compete in a way that will attract people who would otherwise move there. And I'm not sure that that has worked in any sense. I mean, I know it's difficult to measure, but do you think that that sort of competition has worked, Jason?
I don't think so. I think, you know, we've kind of seen the city population decline, unfortunately. And for what it's worth, I don't think, you know, it's a little misguided. I don't think for a lot of people that was the primary motivation of moving to the suburbs. I know a lot of people talk about having like a big yard and that kind of thing, but there's other amenities like access to jobs and access to healthcare that might be a more primary motivator than having a big lawn to mow.
So the first step is to, is it the elimination of minimum setbacks? Would you start there, Jason?
Yeah, I think I would start there. You know, it just adds this unnecessary complexity and, you know, let neighborhoods decide what their neighborhoods would look like.
Even a front patio.
Even a front patio.
Yeah, man. Molly Gaudioso, do you endorse Jason's first proposal?
I do and I don't. So So I think he's absolutely right. Like, our zoning regulations, particularly when you look at how they've created neighborhoods over time, they've reflected changing shifts and preferences of what people are looking for in a neighborhood environment. And you kind of saw the more traditional, denser neighborhoods move into wanting larger lots, and then maybe the suburban environment of having, you know, much more separated aspects of your neighborhood. But we're seeing a huge trend of wanting to go back to that urban, connectivity and being on smaller lots, being closer to your neighbors. Certainly, I think things like allowing for a front yard patio, arguably, what's the difference between your front porch and a front porch patio? Mm-hmm. So certainly those are kind of these legacy regulations that have just been left over in codes that we can address. I think setbacks are one thing to remember in zoning codes, is they are a sliding scale of regulations. And they can be context sensitive. So you can look at a more traditional neighborhood, like, you know, I live over by Beechwood neighborhood, and a lot of the lots are pretty close to the street, but not all the way, abutting the sidewalk, so to speak. And if you were to totally get rid of front setbacks, you might start to see, you know, a change in character, so to speak, where maybe somebody's house, if it goes all the way to the sidewalk, now you can't really see down the street and see all of the front porches and the patios and the, you know, activity that you want to. So, you know, those types of regulations, I think they have responded to a much more suburban character, which is not appropriate for a place like the city neighborhoods. But I do think we can adjust that. And that's an immediate change we could make to rectify that.
Okay. And Jason, before I kick it over to Brendan to adjudicate this one, Jason, how do you feel about the concern that, I take Molly's point that if we have no minimum setbacks and we are right on the street, you might be blocking somebody's view next door.
No, that makes good sense too. You definitely want people to be able to see down the street. Like, I know when I'm on my porch, I'll look down the street just to see, look at the bus stop, make sure I'm not missing my bus, that kind of thing. The line of sight has a lot of purposes, just to make sure you can see what's going on.
So there might be a happy medium somewhere from the current to the ideal. Okay. That's fair enough. Brendan, Ryan, how do you see the question of setbacks, front spaces, and community building?
Yeah, I would tend to echo Molly. It's definitely not entirely an either or proposition. The context is definitely important, especially, you know, if you've got neighborhoods where, you know, you might have a greater line of sight issues. You know, if every house on the street is, say, 10 feet back from the street, then you're not going to block someone's line of sight by being that approximately the same distance. But if you have streets that are, everyone is very set back, and then you say, you know, let's put one closer to the street, then you might create that issue. So it's definitely just, you know, like Molly said, a little more thought into designing, you know, some better language around exactly how to make that most appropriate fit the city environment.
Okay. Molly, what's top of your list for a 2021 wish list for you?
Well, I think, I, as a community planning consultant, I work on help a lot of communities update their zoning codes. And the big thing that I see is there's just, the suburbanization of zoning regulations over time. There's a lot of leftover language that a lot of people are just unaware of that totally limit more of the activity and connectivity that we want to see. Learning from COVID, it's totally possible to have that front outdoor dining space in a lot of cases with restaurants and things like that. In urban environments and urban activity centers, especially, you know, that multi-story mixed use. And a lot of codes that I see actually prohibit that. Making those easy ones, allowing for more of the outdoor seating and dining, allowing for a mixing of uses in your activity centers, allowing for accessory dwelling units in a lot of neighborhoods provides it's an easy step to providing some affordable housing and helping to create a better sense of community. And even, you know, bringing things in like urban agriculture or changing open container laws in some places.
All right, so I want to hit a couple of the points you raised there. And, you know, just on the subject of outdoor dining, if you go back a year ago, there was already conversation in April 2020 about what restaurants were going to need to do to try to be safe but also stay alive. And some of that was expanding outdoor seating. And some of the restaurants, the owners and the managers we were talking to last spring were saying, boy, there's a lot of red tape that if you want to put more tables outside, if you want to put a tent outside, if you want to turn a parking lot into seating space, it takes a lot to get done. And the question was whether local governments were going to be able to respond quickly enough. I think generally speaking, there was a lot of effort on the part of local governments to do that and to do that with enough speed to help restaurants out. But I'm also hearing you, Molly, say that, you know, it sounds like maybe either we still have lessons to learn there or we should be answering the question of why those regulations exist in the first place. So when it comes to outdoor dining, why are there such strict rules as you understand it?
I think the big thing is it's sort of a reaction to the worst case scenario. You know, a lot of codes think about the potential for this horrible impact of having, you know, a bar or restaurant have these a whole number of tables outside and things like that, that if you're in close proximity to a neighborhood and it gets rowdy or things like that, I think, you know, there's this reaction to it. But we've learned over time that there's ways to nuance the code that can help facilitate that and make it better, to help react to that in a way. And the one thing that I think is really difficult, and I give a lot of the communities that were the result of COVID credit for, you know, codes themselves, you end up being reactionary. It's not until the issue comes up or somebody wants to do something that you start to realize that maybe your code isn't working for you necessarily. So going in and proactively changing those laws as a result, I think, was a good step into making that happen. And looking at, you know, a lot of big contentious piece that we hear about a lot is parking spaces and providing parking and thinking about, you know, a lot of the environments where maybe a restaurant took over a parking space in front of their restaurant to make sure that the sidewalk was still clear, but then they had the outdoor spaces. And, you know, the world didn't end. It worked out. So what can we learn from that and allowing that in the future as well?
What do you think, Brendan? Ryan endorsed these ideas? Yes or no?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. I think there's a lot of cases where we need to kind of reanalyze our expectations for what we should be doing, what we shouldn't be doing. You know, a lot of cities have gone a lot farther than Rochester has in terms of creating new public spaces for things like outdoor dining. You know, partial street closures. We do have the whole railroad street outside of Black Button and Roarbox. But, you know, I think there's a lot more examples of things we can do like that. And just, you know, just analyzing how it's really just a question of how do we best use public space to suit the needs of the community. It's, you know, it's restaurants, it's cafes, even, you know, libraries, bookstores. There's a whole bunch of different ways that, you know, may have applications for a private use, a business, or elsewise to be using a public space. And I think we need to take a look at that, see what we can be doing to create some more of these outdoor public spaces that aren't, you know, we have a good amount of parks and that sort of outdoor spaces, but we have a kind of a limitation of public spaces that are used, you know, can be used for other things like dining and things like that.
Mm-hmm. Jason Partika, what do you think?
Oh yeah, no, I think people forget a lot that the largest public space in our communities is the roads. You know, I think people think that that's limited to travel and it's just for cars. But the truth is our streets are as much a public space as like any park or playground or anything like that. And, you know, we do need to do a better job of programming for that public space other than cars. You know, thinking about your typical like idyllic residential neighborhood, you know, once upon a time, people would put like you know, nets in the middle of the residential streets and kids would play street hockey or stuff like that. And it was on, you know, everybody was responsible for driving slow in a residential neighborhood, looking out for kids with the knowledge that it's a public space. And we've kind of gotten away with that. Now people want to go, like, why are these people in the street? Why, you know, you need to get everybody out of the road. And I think, you know, I think a lot of people want to go back to that. And I think a lot of people would really appreciate having the streets as a public space available for more than just cars.
It's like you can see my notes. You're looking ahead in the show here. We're going to talk about how to do that a little bit more in our second half hour. And before I grab Paige on the phone in Rochester, Brendan Ryan, an engineer who sits on the board of Reconnect Rochester, anything else that tops your list for 2021 that we haven't discussed yet that you think can be done in relatively short order?
Oh, well, I guess there's just all sorts of kind of smaller changes. You know, the city is working on updating zoning code right now. You know, the comprehensive plan was completed. And I think there are a lot of kind of simple changes to little issues that are getting in the way of making good urban development and, you know, kind of creating the sort of city environment that we want. You know, everything from the size of a lot that's required to build a house, you know, is currently larger than the size of most existing lots in the city. So it just, things like that increase red tape, all sorts of just little small issues like that that can be pretty easily addressed.
Well, our guests are all offering ideas for what can change, as you just heard from Brendan. Jason Partika, chair of the bus work group at Reconnect Rochester. Molly Gaudioso is a senior community planner at Barton and Logwood East. And let me take our first phone call. This is Paige in Rochester. Hi, Paige. Go ahead.
Hi. I think the idea of having the space out in front of the house is a really good idea, but I currently own a house that's in the Dutchtown neighborhood, and my house is right up to the street. There's no place for a patio. I do have a small backyard, but my house is under 1,000 square feet. But I am interested in staying in the city, but I am interested in a tiny house. Mm-hmm. And I would like to live in a tiny house community with, like, a central courtyard where people could socialize with each other. Mm. And I want to stay in the city, and I want to be on a bus line. So I think the city is building too many expensive high-rise buildings rather than focusing on affordable housing and community.
Paige, thank you. I'm really glad you called. You know, what Paige is talking about is not only a debate here, it's a debate in cities across the country where there are minimum square footage rules. And when it comes to the kind of community that she's thinking about, you know, with a collection of tiny houses, a central square, after Hurricane Katrina, we saw quite a bit of that in Louisiana. And the question then becomes, you know, what are the rules and laws? And Molly, I don't know the update in Rochester, but we get this question often when we talk urbanism. Can you have a tiny house here? And if not, why not? And is that part of the future? What do you think, Molly?
So definitely that's a big thing that comes up with a lot of communities that I work with, and particularly in like village settings or city settings. And the big thing, like Brendan mentioned, is there's often, you know, a lot size, minimum lot size requirement that was way in excess of what the existing sort of development pattern is in neighborhoods. So that's kind of the first barrier that you see is these outdated suburban style lot size requirements. And then, you know, you also can see in a lot of codes this minimum dwelling size requirement that sort of precludes the tiny houses. But that's a very, you know, viable opportunity to serve affordable housing needs, creating these, you know, micro communities within neighborhoods. And there's a lot of potential in the city where you see, you know, some vacant lots that, you know, if there's a handful of vacant lots together, maybe that's an opportunity to create exactly that. You know, a couple tiny homes in a smaller, maybe, you know, courtyard environment, or even just allowing for a smaller subdivision to allow for those homes. And I think that's something that, looking at the city's comprehensive plan, that definitely is, you know, being considered, and is there's a lot of opportunity as part of our zoning code update to make those things happen.
Hmm. Brendan, Ryan, what do you think?
Yeah, for sure. There's some weird things in that specific case that preclude, the issue of tiny houses specifically. If you have multiple units on one lot, that's not really allowed. If you end up doing that, you're ending up treating a collection of small houses as an apartment building, and all the requirements that are baked into that then are translated to trying to apply that to a group of small houses. And that doesn't really work because that's not actually what you're doing. So modernizing some code issues that, can more effectively address issues like that are really important.
Okay. Jason, you want to add to that?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. I kind of think of the stuff that's going on in our housing market right now and how hard it is for people to even find houses. I bought my own house back in 2019. It was kind of the same boat. And I ended up, kind of the same story. I ended up getting a house on my fifth bid, and I ended up having to buy a house with 2,000 square feet all for myself, which is just insane. When I first lived here, I probably used 600 feet of it. There were whole rooms I didn't go into for months, that kind of thing. And I think there's a real pent-up demand for just smaller living arrangements, be it a tiny house, be it a condo, be it like a townhouse, whatever it is. I think it's definitely something that needs to be explored.
Steve in Brighton called in to say there's a tiny house community outside of Ithaca called Boyceville Cottages. And I was not aware of that, but Steve directs our attention there. I appreciate that, Steve. Thank you very much. And listeners, if you want to call the program, it's 844-295-TALK, 844-295-8255, 263-WXXI if you're in Rochester, 263-9994. Or you can email the program connections@WXXI.org and have an email from Evan, who says the following. Speaking of cities trying to compete with the suburbs and making things worse as a result, the original 1905 A shed at the public market that ran the full east-west length of the market was demolished in the 1960s to make more surface parking available for the suburban, automotive-minded people that were demanding parking spaces wherever they went. The public market was in trouble at that time when the regional market opened in Henrietta as a direct response to suburbanization and preferences. At that time, it was seen by many or most that the city market would go away in favor of the suburban one. The city public market tried to survive by making itself more convenient to the suburban driver and to the overall suburban mindset, and the casualty was the original 1905 A shed. The result was 55 years of ugly asphalt where a beautiful building used to be. The new D shed returned a building to half of that spot in 2017, but many people were very against that new building for fear that it would eliminate precious parking spaces. This, to me, is a cautionary tale of trying to replicate the suburbs in the city. That's from Evan. Thank you, Evan. Jason Partika, do you agree with him?
I do. I actually live in the Market View Heights neighborhood, and I can assure people there's plenty of parking. I notice it on Saturdays when the market is open. There's more parking on my streets, but there's still empty spaces. And we also border the neighborhood of the arts, too. So whenever there's something going on at the Auditorium Theater or the Armory, again, plenty of street parking for people. So I definitely think we're really just way overbuilt on parking, and it's unfortunate because it makes other attractions like the public market half the size that they could be. And we should definitely infill parking lots and not worry about where people are going to park. People will find a way.
Okay, Brendan, what do you think?
Absolutely, yeah. It's been kind of shown time and time again, in other cities as well as here. If you build something that's interesting that people want to go to, they'll go there, whether they drive there and they walk from their cars, they take the bus, they carpool, they bike there. People, if someone wants to go somewhere, they're going to go there despite, if it's a little bit harder to drive. you know, that's not something that really stands in the way of most people.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so some of our biggest attraction, you know, when you think about the fact that New York City is, you know, probably one of the largest attractions and tourist destinations in the country, and, you know, no one drives there, you know, everyone figures out another way to be in New York City because you don't drive there, because it's crazy. And, you know, we can do a lot of that same stuff right here.
Molly Gaudioso, what do you think?
I agree. You know, particularly when you're considering these sort of destination centers like the Public Market that are already pretty established. You know, you think about that. You think about, you know, Shane Place and Village of Pittsford. If you're driving there, you're driving around a while, probably trying to find a parking space. And I think we do have this overreaction to making sure that everybody can find one in the exact designated spot that you want, you know, want them to. But, you know, there are opportunities with on-street parking, sharing, you know, public parking. I think a big issue with that is just awareness, people not knowing where they can park, wayfinding, things like that. The resistance still that we see from more that suburban mentality to wanting to park right in front of where you're trying to go, not wanting to have to, you know, walk a little bit. Maybe you have to walk a block or so to get to where you were trying to go. But I do think there are cases that come up where you have to be considerate of the balance necessary and the impacts to the surrounding neighborhoods and what you're putting, you know, what demand you might be putting on them. You know, maybe like it's that Saturday overflow and that, you know, that might not be a huge deal, but if that's like a constant thing that, you know, could end up being a problem. But I think that that's something that's going to be phased out. You know, as Jason said, we're oversupplied in parking already. So we can balance that out. And as we start to see reduced reliance on automobiles, particularly in urban places, that's going to become less and less of a problem.
The Congress for the New Urbanism published their list of 25 of urbanism's best ideas that they want to see universally adopted. And one of them was rethinking parking. And they write, quote, parking policies had an impact like B-52 bombers on many downtowns. In Buffalo, somebody said a few years back, if the goal was to destroy downtown, well, we halfway succeeded. That's a better job than the Germans did to London. And now from coast to coast, more sensible parking policies are finally taking hold, and they may be the quickest path to urban revitalization. Rethinking parking at the top of the list. I know every time we talk parking here, we get a flood of emails from people who have very strong views on this. We're not just talking parking this hour. We're going to come right back, and we're going to talk about a number of other, some of the other things that you want to talk about, listeners. We're going to talk about suburban retrofit. We're going to talk about context-based street design, what that means, and what else might change with Molly Gaudioso, who is a senior community planner at Barton in Lagoudis, Jason Partika, chair of the bus work group at Reconnect Rochester, and Brendan Ryan is an engineer who's on the board of Reconnect, and we're right back with them next. I'm Evan Dawson. Tuesday on The Next Connections, disease transmission is way down in our community, and I'm not talking about COVID. We're talking about so many other things, including the common cold. When's the last time you were sick? Masking and distance has had an effect. And the question is, when the pandemic subsides, what are the changes that will become permanent? Will you keep your masks handy in grocery stores or elsewhere? We'll talk about it with doctors Tuesday. This is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Let's close the loop on tiny houses. Steve in Brighton on the phone. Hi, Steve. Go ahead.
Oh, hi, Evan. Good show.
Thank you,
sir. Part of my education's in planning, so I find it interesting. Over outside of Ithaca, you might look this up on your computer while you're sitting there, but over on the other side of Ithaca in Brooktondale, New York, there's a tiny house community. And it's called the Boyce, B-O-I-C-E, Boyceville Cottages. It's just fabulous, okay? So I just wanted to pass that on, all right?
Now, can I just ask briefly, when you say it's fabulous, I mean, I don't know how long it's been there. What's attractive about it to you?
I don't know. I'm thinking less than 10 years.
Yeah.
It's a large parcel of land with tiny houses. And I don't know. The way it was explained to me was that it was possibly inexpensive housing for college students, maybe graduate students, and it became so popular for lots of people that it expanded and has grown over the last 10 years. You have, architecture varies with the person, but it's subjective, but this is a tiny house community of what I would call late Victorian designed houses. So it's almost like a little Chautauqua community out there. Okay. But they have a common area, and each house has a little yard. They're not real close to each other, okay? They're not compact. In an urban environment, they'd be much more compact, I would think, okay?
Sure.
But it's just something I wanted to mention since the person called in about it. I think they're a great idea, and I'm sure that they break the laws in regard to codes in every possible way. But I think they're a great idea. And hell, I'm 68. I'd like to live in one, okay?
Very interesting. And so Boyceville Cottages, we're going to do a little homework on that for a future conversation.
Your homework.
Thank you, Steve.
Okay.
As always, interesting. Yeah, Boyceville Cottages. And interesting, Steve says he's 68. He's interested. Sometimes the stereotype is, that there is maybe a limited market for this, but we'll see. I'm very curious to know what the next 5 years includes for a tiny house community and opportunities everywhere, not just east of Ithaca. But thank you, Steve. I appreciate that. Yeah, is that you, Molly? You want to jump in?
Yeah, if I could just add to that, too. I think we're seeing that trend in a lot of communities, too, with patio home developments, mm-hmm. where they're much smaller, they're closer together, and they're generally, built in more of a community environment. There's shared spaces, even if it's just sort of passive open space, connected with sidewalks. And that's a huge trend that, with empty nesters, seniors wanting to live in that more dense environment, in addition to, millennials, younger people, young professionals, and even young families.
All right. Thank you, Steve. Let me get Rich in Rochester next on the phone. Go ahead, Rich.
Hi, Evan. How are you doing today?
Good, sir.
I know that you talked about the Metro Center call, the calls from Metro Center last week. I'm sorry I missed that that episode, but for me as a city dweller, the loss of that was, it angered and saddened me. It was for such a huge part of the community. It added a level of services to the city that there's nothing in the city that replaces it. I think there are many businesses, including Wegmans, who are abandoning the city, except if you're talking in your more affluent white areas like the east side of East Avenue. And that is a huge, that bothers me a lot. And this I think this has to stop, this whole movement.
Well, Rich, I appreciate the phone call and the sentiment. And let me just say, to Rich and to everybody who has followed up on our conversation with George Rommel, the CEO of the Y, and some others last week, I promise you, no matter what side you're on, we have attempted to have that conversation fairly and directly. I will also say that I think it is my job to ask hard questions about why certain decisions are made. I also think it's fair to say that the YMCA, just as every other organization, does not exist outside of the forces of what's happening in its community. In other words, George Rommel said that the last 20 years have been really tough in the city. A lot of what we had hoped for growth, for job growth, for new tech quarters, et cetera, hasn't materialized. And that makes it harder. And there's no doubt that that's true. Now, I don't think that the only way that you ought to be staying on, on with the mission that you have in the city is if things go well. I think you need to plan for all scenarios. And I'm sure George and the team is. And they're good people. I'm sure they care. I also think you can't say that it's just something that you are outside of, because if you end up after 20 years building two palaces in the suburbs and closing 67% of your city locations, you are not just living in a community that's seeing a shift to the suburbs. You are helping facilitate that. And that's why we asked the questions we did. It wasn't to be rude or unfair, but that's part of the job here. And George is up front I wouldn't want that job. I think it's very, very difficult. And I'm a big YMCA person. I grew up in a family that, you know, sent their kids to Y camps, and I was a camp counselor for years. I love the Y. I love its mission, and I hope that they can find ways to continue serving the city. And George and the team says that they will. So, Rich, I appreciate that. And, you know, I don't know if our guests have anything to add on the Y. I mean, Jason, anything you want to add there?
Not really. I think everything that needs to be said has been said about it. I was also disappointed to see they're leaving, but, you know, I don't think anything else to add to that.
Okay. Yeah, Molly?
You know, like you said, I think it's just they're responding to trends, and the, you know, most affluent families who are likely to buy Y memberships are looking for, you know, the state-of-the-art things. But, yeah, there is a responsibility, I think, in maintaining some presence and opportunities in the city, and making sure that it's an equitable opportunity for those programs and recreation. I think the city is long overdue for a major investment in a community center of some kind that can compete, and not necessarily compete, but can match what we're seeing out in the suburbs and the types of community centers that are being built there.
Yeah, George Rommel did say he wants to see more community partnerships and government partnerships. He says right now they feel like they have to go it alone. So we'll see if that changes. Brendan, Ryan, anything you want to add there?
No, I don't think so. Basically agree with what Molly said.
Okay, very good. So on the subject of the Y, by the way, listeners, we're going to talk about the future of summer camps, which a lot of news in the last few weeks about that this summer, and we will be talking to the Y, among others, with that. And listeners, if you go to camps, send your kids to camps, etc., send me a note on what you want to see represented, because we're going to be doing that very, very soon. Let me redirect back to the way we think about how we plan. And our guests have talked about not just auto-centric planning, but also when you think about, you know, sort of how we lay out a street, what the goal is. And I want to read again from the Congress of New Urbanism's list. One of their recommended features is context-based street design, and I'll read from that now. Quote, "Streets are the bones of a community, and bones are designed according to where they are in the body. Imagine if you had a femur on your finger. It would not work well. Similarly, the streets must be designed according to what is around them and the activities that are needed and desired." That's what context-based street design is all about. And they pointed to, just as an example, Colorado Avenue, which is in a town called Stuart, Florida. The desired target speed was an issue for a while. So they had a lot of speed, a lot of cars going faster than the people who live in there wanted, the people who are walking wanted. So they achieved what they wanted with the target speed by using a combination of tools. They used a raised street crossing, so not just a crosswalk, but a raised crosswalk, curb extensions, inset parking, trees and ground cover, all used to slow down traffic as the road approached a key intersection in this sort of quaint little downtown. And looking at the picture, I thought it was fascinating because it looked to me more like sort of old Europe than modern American planning. Molly, when you think about, as a senior community planner yourself, how can we, you know, add context to street design to make sure, number one, we're getting the achieved speeds we want, we're getting the achieved walkability we want? How do we do that better?
That entirely comes down to the relationship between the public and private realms. So particularly in an urban context, you know, it can be challenging because you're dealing with limited right-of-way in where the streets are, where sidewalks are, things like that. But the biggest, you know, lesson is to start to identify these typologies for whether it's a neighborhood street, whether it's more of a neighborhood commercial corridor, maybe it's the major, you know, downtown street network. What is it that you're designing for? In all urban environments, you should be thinking about all modes of transportation. You should be thinking about accessibility all the time. And I think this Rochester is trying to do a lot, you know, more with that. We have a lot of bike initiatives and, you know, sidewalk connectivity that we're trying to make happen. But paired with that has to come the private side. When you look at a street and as you're walking down, all you see is parking lots lining the street. Even if you have a sidewalk to walk on as a pedestrian, you do not feel comfortable. You know, limiting from a private development, if your parking requirements are huge, or, you know, you're not allowing for shared parking or things like that, you're going to have
so many more curb cuts potentially that a pedestrian or, you know, a cyclist has to manage with that brings more potential conflict points for crashes, you know, and things like that. So you want to make sure that your private regulations or your zoning actually matches what it is you're trying to do in the public realm as well. So, you know, no matter the improvements that we're making to our streetscapes to be, you know, more complete and provide multimodal access opportunities, if you're counteracting that on the private side, it's really not going to help. And a big piece of that, too, is updating codes to make sure you're requiring new development and investment on the private side to connect to the existing infrastructure, help to improve a lot of those facilities and maintain those connections. Don't just dump a pedestrian from the sidewalk into the curb cut of the parking lot. You know, how do you provide that path to the buildings, to the destinations as well?
What do you think, Brendan Ryan, about how we think about how we're laying out and whether we're doing a good job of that in our community?
Absolutely. I mean, I think we're starting to incorporate some of that thinking into our design. We certainly should be doing a lot more. You know, there's all sorts of manner, you know, things where we, you know, that gets in the whole zoning discussion about parking requirements, and, you know, driveways on private properties, requirements for bike parking, transit amenities provided by private entities, all sorts of things like that. And I think that, you know, these next couple of years, you know, hopefully with the new zoning code, some of those things are taken into account. But we definitely, you know, we need to look elsewhere, I think, is really the lesson that we, especially, you know, as Americans, we tend to be a little bit myopic and looking at, you know, just what's happening here. But, you know, there's all sorts of examples that we can find from all over the world of, you know, what things work, what things don't, and, you know, some innovative ideas that could really help transform communities.
Well, and I have, Jason Partika, a long flood of email. You've all touched a nerve here. I'll let you weigh in on this, and then I'm going to get through as much of the feedback from listeners as I can. What would you like to add there, Jason?
I think they did a good job touching on it. You know, again, with our built-out spaces and parking in general, I think sometimes people might even think, like, do they want more parking? Like, even, like, more suburban towns and villages, like, if you've ever been stuck in traffic on Main Street in the town of Victor, Route 96, mm-hmm. Trying to get someplace, like, do you want more car-oriented destinations there in your village? Same thing maybe out in Webster, whenever there's a construction on the Bay Bridge and everybody has to go down Empire. You know, I have coworkers who complain they have to wait for 40 minutes. And it's like, do you want more sprawling car-centric development on Webster when you're already stuck in traffic for so long? It's like, maybe it is time to think about, like, walkable, not car-centric development where you're not getting stuck all over the place because of all these cars trying to get here or there.
If I could just add two really quick to that, I think the moral of the story is, you know, reclaiming space. We've overbuilt streets for cars over, you know, and so small things like reducing lane sizes can really give you the opportunity for more of those amenities and reclaiming that space, bringing in something that actually creates a sense of place, like street trees or, you know, other accommodations in the outside of vehicular travel lanes that really just helps to create that sense of place and a much more connected community.
Brenda in Brockport says, I live in the village of Brockport. If you look at the local neighborhood watch group on Facebook, you would think this is an incredibly friendly and social town. And for the most part, it is. People are always helping and advising each other, especially in the event of tragedies. At the same time, I've been going on long walks during the pandemic, and I've seen an astonishing number of high stockade fences going up around me. For neighbors with small children and dogs, I totally understand the desire to enclose their yards. In other cases, I'm mystified. In older parts of Brockport, with tall Victorian homes standing close together, neighbors can clearly see into each other's properties, so these high stockade fences seem to serve one purpose only, to prevent casual interactions with your neighbors. What do people really want from each other? Is the fencing industry booming? What's happening here? I would love to hear your guests' thoughts on this. Brendan Ryan, is that a concern? Do we feel, is it sort of like this this desire to wall ourselves off from one another?
I mean, I think that's probably true for some people. And, you know, I think that's one of the places where, you know, the city design, you know, or, you know, not even just the city, but, you know, municipal design, you know, maybe that's something that the village should start to address of, you know, this is detrimental to the public good as a whole and the feeling of our neighborhoods. And that's something that shouldn't be allowed. That may be, you know, what needs to happen in that sort of situation.
Jason Partika, what do you think?
Yeah, you know, I think when it comes to privacy, you know, sometimes what people really want is like window privacy, you know, and you have to ask yourself, do you want a big fence or do you just need a nice set of curtains? You know what I mean? So, and I think everybody wants kind of, you know, like a person's home is their castle, right? And sure, people want a private space, but I think a lot of us who have been cooped up for a year, I think we've had our fill of private space sometimes as well. So I would definitely, when we talk about zoning or community planning in general, just remind people what you want today may not be what you want tomorrow. Mm-hmm. You definitely want publicly active space.
Molly, do good fences make good neighbors?
Personally, I would say no, but, you know, I think that's one of the difficulties of regulating private property is particularly when you're looking at a situation like that, you know, it is personal preference. A lot of times when I go into communities, fencing is a big concern, and it's largely because there's property owner, you know, discontent between neighbors, and they, you know, want to put up that fence for a reason. But I think there's ways, and like the city's, you know, does it relatively well in limiting heights and things and opacities of fences. But that's really a personal preference, I think. And a fence is relatively easy thing to take out for the next homeowner or, you know, whoever. But and I agree with what Jason said. It'd be interesting to see if their preference changes as a result of everybody having been sort of shut-ins for the last year.
Yeah. Patrick offers an idea. He says, with the pandemic, pool sales skyrocketed, and if you have a pool in your backyard, you have to have a fence around it, mm-hmm. most likely. And with a pool, people want privacy anyway. It's probably half the reason fences are going up. I don't know if it's half, mm-hmm. but certainly pool sales are up. So that's, you know, that's one of the reasons. But I think it's layered. I think there's a lot there. Let me squeeze in one more. This is from your friend Matt Denker, who says, Evan, how do we square the circle that is the city and its citizens' stated desire for housing choice while maintaining a zoning code that, through a series of explicit design standards, effectively makes illegal any new housing that is not exactly like the housing that already exists? Molly, what do you think?
I mean, I agree. And again, I think that's one of the purposes, at least it's my understanding. I don't want to speak for the city, but from what I've heard, and it's my understanding that, you know, it's widely recognized that Rochester's code is a barrier to those types of things. And there's opportunities in a lot of neighborhoods to look at how you open the door to allow for, you know, we have single family exclusionary zoning. How can you in neighborhoods where it's palatable allow for, you know, 2-3 family homes to be built on single lots that may be vacant to help make it more viable? Not a lot of people are buying a vacant lot and building a single family home right now. So, you know, giving people the opportunity to have an accessory dwelling unit that provides an affordable housing option. It can help people remain in their homes, aging in place for seniors, give some supplemental income. You know, changing those lot size requirements and some of the density requirements to really bring in alternative housing options and providing in a lot more other, you know, in a lot of other contexts, upper floor residential, smaller scale residential that meets some of that demand. I think having not knowing a lot about the Boyceville cottages, but the demand on that, you know, raises price of the home. So while it might be intended to be something that's affordable or, you know, originally for students or things like that, when you have so many people looking for it, you know, that ends up getting rid of it. So we see the demand. We need to make sure that we're creating regulations that can facilitate building for that demand.
Brendan Ryan, what do you think?
Yeah, absolutely. You know, we need to have a zoning code that works for what the current market is. And, you know, if we're realizing that there have been a lot of issues caused by single family exclusionary zoning and by our attempts to make the city more suburban and not address, you know, some of the pressures that are out there, the market pressures and housing preference pressures, you know, those are things we really need to address and make sure that we're not trying to preserve what we have for the sake of preserving what we have, but look at what we need.
Jason, 30 seconds. Go ahead.
Yeah, I'm going to drop a bomb at the very end. Like, whenever I see the phrase preserving the character of a neighborhood, it always makes me cringe. I don't think that phrase has ever been used to do anything I'd like. So, again, I think, you know, there's a demographic shift going on in the city, and, you know, people want different things. You know, what is a neighborhood except the neighbors that live in it? And we really need to examine, what changes they want when we build out.
I want to thank our guests for taking the time on this Monday afternoon to share how they view the state of urbanism, connected communities, design, and all of the things that might be on their 2021 list for that they'd like to see accomplished. It won't all happen this year, but I think this conversation helps communities keep it at the center. Jason Partika, chair of the Bus Work Group at Reconnect Rochester, thanks for being with us.
No, thank you.
Molly Gaudioso, a senior community planner at Barton and Laguadis. Thank you, Molly.
Thank you.
Brendan Ryan, an engineer who sits on the board of Reconnect Rochester. Thank you, Brendan.
Thanks for having me.
Our thanks to Rob Braden, engineer, Tim Shea, volunteer, Megan Mack, producer. I'm Evan Dawson. Have a nice afternoon. We'll talk to you Tuesday on member-supported Public Radio.